Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I'm so glad you could join us for a little talk about some classic and not-so-classic baseball cards as we go diving into the various monster boxes and binders and shoe boxes that we all have. And while I appreciate you joining in today, I also appreciate you for your patience. I kind of sound like an on-hold message, don't I? Thank you for your patience. We will be with you in just a moment. Our menu of options has changed. When has the phone system menu of options not changed? Wouldn't that be something if you called somebody and you go right to the system and they go, our menu of options hasn't changed because, well, we really haven't done anything new or exciting here. Well, that's a conversation for another time. But anyways, I do appreciate your patience because I did, when we were recording the previous episode a few weeks ago, I did intend on having a show on schedule March 22nd. And I even commented during that show, I said, well, I'm on vacation the week leading up to the 22nd, so I'll find some way to get it done. And it became very, very quickly apparent to me that with vacation and then work sandwiching vacation and then just life in general, that this wasn't going to happen. It just, as much as I wanted to, it was just like, you know, I think I'll just punt for a week and I think the listeners will understand. And you certainly did. And I thank you for that. Now, just to set the record straight, we're not going to try to make up for last week by having another podcast a week from today. We're going to keep it at the 2 week interval. So we've got this podcast. Our next one is 2 weeks from today. That is Friday, April the 12th. And then we'll continue every 2 weeks from then on out until we have the next interruption in life that kind of postpones a show for a week or two. But that's the plan there. And I think you're going to enjoy not only today's show, but the next episode as well. As thanks to your financial contributions, we were able to secure several different types of cards, kind of cover the whole spectrum of card collecting with some unopened packs and boxes. And let me talk about 2 weeks from now, the next episode, we are going to open up a pack of 1977 Tops. And that is a pack that, again, through some contributions from our listeners, we were able to get through an eBay auction. Very nice seller who delayed the delivery of the pack until I got back into town. So that was very nice. And we're going to open that up. We'll unveil that in a video break on April the 11th. That'll be Thursday, April the 11th. And we'll see what is inside that pack. But around whatever is inside that pack when we open it, we're also going to have a little discussion about the fine art of airbrushing. Yes, 77 Tops was the first set of expansion teams where Tops released the set in one series as opposed to multiple series. That was the luxury they had in 1961, 62, and 69, where the first 2 to 3 series of cards featured players with their new teams where they had airbrushed out logos or, you know, the usual photograph from, you know, basically underneath their hat so you couldn't see the logo, or their hat was removed. And Topps got around to eventually adding some spring training photos of players in their new uniforms with their new teams in the later series, you know, series 4, 5, 6, 7, the high number series as the set went on. Well, in 1977, Topps was by then in its fourth year of releasing the whole set as just one series. So that presented a very, very unique challenge where the expansion draft for the Toronto Blue Jays and the Seattle Mariners was held in November of 1976. And the Topps set was rolling out in March of 1977. So Topps had this roughly 4.5 month turnaround time to get the expansion rosters, go through their files, find the pictures of the various players and even coaches and managers. And then they had to airbrush the Blue Jays logo, which was not an easy logo to airbrush. There's a lot of moving parts in that original Blue Jay logo, which is similar to the one they have now. And the Seattle Mariner pitchfork, if you will. The the Trident, that was a lot easier, but still they had to go through and basically, alter 25 cards for each team. I believe the number's 25 around there. And, there's some interesting stories as to how they did airbrushing and the photography behind it. And I went through my collection and found, I think, maybe about 9 or 10 cards of Blue Jays and Mariners from 1977. A couple more Blue Jays than Mariners, but still a pretty good assortment of cards and some interesting player stories behind the players that are featured. And, again, these are just cards I pulled out of a box of 77 tops that I have here. So that's going to be fun. That'll be 2 weeks from today. And our episode this week will feature 1992 Upper Deck. If you saw the video link yesterday, which was sent out via our Twitter account, Wax and Gum Stains, or if you go onto YouTube, just type in Wax Ecstatic 1992 Upper Deck Box Break. You'll see it. Instead of showing you the entire box, I basically just took the top four packs and ripped them open. A little bit of a spoiler alert here. Yes, did get a Manny Ramirez rookie out of one of the four packs there. Slight ding to one of the corners. I will say, as I opened up the rest of the box later, that I did pull another Ramirez. Also, some good young stars from that time. Ken Griffey Jr., Frank Thomas, and some established stars as well. Mark McGuire, Jose Canseco, and then you've got more veteran players, Paul Molitor and Robin Yount and George Brett and Cal Ripken Jr. and Ryan Sandberg, all those guys. So a pretty fun collection of some star players, but as we will discuss in today's program, because 92 Upper Deck falls right in the heart of the junk wax era, not a whole lot of cash value to these cards, but because this was part of a bargain bin purchase, it's kind of like what we did with 92 tops a couple months ago. I bought a box of 92 tops. I think it was for $7 or $9. And it's just like, well, why not? Here's $7. I'll take this box of unopened cards off your hands and just have some fun. And that's basically what I did. I spent maybe about an hour just ripping through all these packs and finding some pretty interesting cards that were in there. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But again, I want to give a quick plug to our PayPal account. That's paypal.me/waxecstatic. We had 3 or 4 contributions come in over the past few weeks. And the kindness and generosity of these listeners who chipped in $10 here or $20 there helped us purchase these packs. The 4 boxes that I picked up at the local card show, grand total for all 4 of those boxes was $37. So basically, we got $9.25 for each of those boxes. And I'll give you a little more backstory into that purchase in a moment. And then the 77 Tops pack purchased on eBay, got it for a reasonable price. And for 77 Tops from a reputable dealer, getting it for under $40, in my opinion, is a reasonable price. So we were able to do that. That is where your money goes. If you make a donation, that's where it goes. It also goes to the maintenance of the program. We host our shows on Audio Boom. We also have our archive through Audio Boom, and that RSS feed from Audio Boom feeds every other platform that you can listen to the show on, or listen the show on. There we go. And that includes iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Blueberry, Spotify, Google Play, other various platforms that basically just grab onto the RSS feeds and distribute them. Your money goes right back into the show. And I say it over and over again that if you do make a contribution, you're either maintaining the show, maintaining the archive episodes of our shows. We've done over 125 episodes now. And it also goes to the purchase of these packs. So we've got some early 90s stuff in the hopper. We've got that 77 Tops pack ready to go for the next episode. I still have some leftover cello packs from several months back. I want to say an 82 Tops, maybe an 86 Fleer. Maybe we'll open those up in a future show. And also, I do want to replenish some early to mid 80s Tops and Fleer and Donruss. Open up those packs and talk about some of those particular sets and some of the players in them. So remember, any donation you make, whether it's $2, $20, somewhere in between, somewhere more than that, it goes right back into the program and keeps it alive, keeps it going, and keeps the purchases coming so that we together can share in the opening of packs or the acquisition of some vintage cards that we discuss. So again, paypal.me/waxecstatic is the way to go there. Now, before we get to the 92 Upper Deck, a couple of thoughts that came in through our Wax Ecstatic, or Wax and Gum Stains, I should say, Twitter feed for Wax Ecstatic. First, one that was forwarded on by Nick Diente, our guest in the last episode. And thanks again for Nick for joining us in that last episode as we talked about the 1970 top set and how did it compare and contrast to the 2019 Topps Heritage set. And the question from the account 1 Million Cubs Project, who now follows us, so thank you for doing that. The question to Nick was, do you think the gimmicky Topps sets, now Living, TBT, On Demand, etc., will be looked at in the hobby 20 years down the road in a similar fashion we view Broder cards of the 80s and 90s licensing aside? And that was a very good question. And Nick and I briefly discussed it in our conversation. So if you want to go back to the archive, the previous episode, you can listen to Nick's answer on that. And I agree with Nick that time will only tell, you know, especially you look at Topps now and you look at the Living set. You know, these have only been around for a couple years. And is there a gimmicky feel to it? A little bit. Let's be honest. This is, you know, on demand, you know, in a certain time window produced products. So, yes, there is a marketing aspect to it. And I've even said this, even though I'm not a big fan of Topps Living or Topps Now, that doesn't mean I don't like it. It's just, I'm not, you know, it's just not my thing. But I realize what those types of issues are. Those are very smart business decisions by Topps to not just live on the value of the base sets that they put out every year. And it's like clockwork. You've got your Topps base set. You've got your Heritage set. You've got your opening day set. You've got Bowman that comes out later on in the year. You've got all these other sets here. Instead of just living on those, they create these more in-the-moment, on-demand sets with limited availability. And it's very smart business. It really is. And I commend Topps for coming up with these unique ways of, you know, not just putting a set out in March or April and trying to, you know, suck all the energy out of that to, you know, make it through the fiscal year. You know, you have to keep innovating and have to have some more current in-the-moment items to kind of keep the hobby moving. So is there a little bit of a gimmick to it? Yes, but it's also very, very smart business and forward-thinking, too. This is a pretty unique thing that Topps has done, that even though Topps has the corner on the baseball card market, other sports such as football and hockey, and I know Topps has a finger on MLS and soccer, but all the other sports and other card makers that are out there, I don't believe are doing anything quite like Topps is doing with the Living and Now sets and some of the other on-demand sets that they are doing. Now, time will tell. I can't predict the future 20 years from now. If I did, I'd be putting money on every World Series champion. But I think this is a little different than the Broder cards, but also some other examples like the Kmart 25th anniversary cards of 1962. Or 1982, I should say, and that's the 20th anniversary. Math was not my strongest subject. The Kmart 20th anniversary cards, or even, you know, the post-serial cards, the Hostess Twinkie cards of the 1970s and 80s, all those other cards, you know, there's a little bit of a difference. And I think the biggest difference is that when you look back at Broder cards, when you look at it, you know, the TCMA cards, when you look at Post and all those other cards and Hostess and Coca-Cola and Burger King, there is a mass appeal to those cards. In fact, Kmart is the best example of overproduction, where in 1982 they created that nice little subset of MVP cards where Topps actually had to create some new MVP cards, some new retro cards, like Maury Wills was the National League MVP in 1962. They had to create a 1962 Topps Maury Wills card because he didn't actually have one back then. But Kmart mass-produced those sets, and there are still cases of them, you know, nearly 40 years later, sitting in warehouses. And if you wanted the Kmart 20th anniversary set, you can buy one in mint condition for just a few dollars. It's not that hard to find. And likewise, you know, with Post and Hostess, you know, all these cards that you can cut out off of a cereal box or a bread box, or not a bread box, you know, a Twinkies box. You know, cards that you got in your box of Raisin Bran or your Bazooka bubble gum. There was a mass appeal there. They kind of flooded the market, and granted, there is some limited availability because over time those cards got thrown away, or, you know, they weren't cut out of the box properly and they were in bad condition. Still, you were flooding the market and then waiting for the market to kind of recede the number of cards that were out there. But with, you know, the Topps Now and the Topps Living sets, you know, those are ones that are on demand. You have to go out and order those. You have to purchase those. And that's what keeps the limited availability numbers down. So I think while there may be a gimmicky part there, there is also a true cash value and maybe a sentimental value to some of these particular cards here. So I don't think it'll be seen as gimmicky in 20 years. I know it seems a little odd right now, but I just don't see it as gimmicky. And because I think it's limited availability, I don't think it's quite as flooded the market like some of those other examples that we brought up. So that's my thought about it. We'll see over time. And like I said, even though I've not really collected the Now or the Living cards, I think it's brilliant business, brilliant marketing by Topps to at least explore this. And we may not need to wait 20 years down the line to see if it's gimmicky or just a fad that fades. Topps will probably figure out in about 4 or 5 years if this is something that they need to continue, whether in a mass appeal or just a niche market. So thank you, 1 Million Cubs Project, and also Nick D'Unti for bringing up that discussion in our timeline last week. Also a question from our good friend Doug McCready. Thoughts on Ichiro? I think it is awesome that he played in Japan. Yeah, he is not the same player anymore, but that was quite a send-off and done really well. All retired players probably jealous. Yeah, I have to agree on that last point first. Is that, you know, Ichiro was able to call his retirement on his terms. And not every player gets that. And then sometimes when a player gets that, it's not always the cleanest farewell tour. And the best example I can think of is Cal Ripken Jr. Now, Cal Ripken Jr., by all stretches of the imagination, deserved every bit of a farewell tour, not only because what he meant to the Baltimore Orioles for so many years, but also the Iron Man streak, what a big pillar in the Baltimore and the Maryland as a whole community he was and still is, and he's still giving back to the game with the, you know, the Little Leagues and, you know, everything else that he's done over the past, it's almost 20 years since he's been retired, believe it or not. But sometimes it's a bit of a clunky break. And in the case of Cal Ripken Jr., the Baltimore Orioles were not a very good team when his retirement came around. There was all sorts of controversy and a lot of venom at Orioles owner Peter Angelos then, and well, you could say now, but certainly back then, you know, the Orioles had this nice little run of competition, competitive play in the mid to late 90s, but now they're just kind of dying on the vine in 2001. And the Cal Ripken Jr. Retirement tour that season had kind of a sad feel to it. Whereas you look at Derek Jeter a few years ago, even Alex Rodriguez, you know, A-Rod has a lot of controversy around him, but there were some benchmarks that he cleared, steroid-induced or not, there were some benchmarks that he cleared over time. And there was still somewhat of a festive feel, a tip of the cap, an acknowledgement that, controversy aside, you know, he had a good career. But, you know, those two guys, they were with the Yankees. And with Cal Ripken and the Orioles, there were some points in the farewell tour where it kind of felt like a funeral dirge. Now, even though Ichiro was wrapping up his career, bouncing around from one team or another, I have to say that the fact that he was able to pretty much call the retirement farewell tour kind of on his shots, the fact that you had the A's and the Mariners playing in Japan in the preseason where Ichiro's career all started, and the fact that Ichiro is still one of those veteran players who could still contribute and still be a good locker room presence speaks very well of just his whole career. And living in Florida, I was able to see a lot of the tail end of his career, you know, spending, a season and a half with the Marlins. You know, the Marlins roster going through, I mean, now they've pretty much traded away everybody. But he was there, you know, after the Jose Fernandez death. He was there when you had all of this potential in the Giancarlo Stanton and the Christian Yelich and the JT Realmuto, you know, all of these young guys that were really good but couldn't quite get the team over the hump. You know, having a guy like Ichiro in the room who can still contribute and who can still, you know, make contact, to say the least, that's a good presence to have around young guys. Yeah, it's a little bit of a circus having the Japanese media still following him around everywhere. But from everything I've heard, it's been nothing but positive experiences with him on and off the field. So when you look at it that way, I think you have to tip the cap to Ichiro as well. I thought it was well played, well scheduled, well executed, and for an absolute Hall of Famer. And of course, you can argue, well, does his Japanese hitting numbers, you know, does that factor into his major league career numbers? Well, no matter which side of the argument you are on that, as in, yes, he's the all-time hits leader beyond Pete Rose, or no, you know, it's just his major league numbers that count. This guy needs to be in Cooperstown in 6 years. There should be a big celebration for him. And an absolute star to the game. You know, we look at especially Shohei Ohtani nowadays. You know, that's where the torch has been passed to. And you look back at Japanese-born players, a lot of the players, when there was a big splash in Japanese player signings in the mid to late 90s, most of them were pitchers. But, you know, Ichiro, I think, was the first. I don't know if the first, but certainly the best hitting import from Japan that baseball was able to bring in. And unfortunately, in his career, there's still a lot of, you know, there's still a lot of what if, you know, because he didn't win a World Series, and that's something that, you know, it's kind of like Dan Marino and the Dolphins. You know, it's one of those things that. You know, it's going to hang over his head, even though, honestly, it really shouldn't. Let me see if I can pull up his career numbers here. Let's see. Oh, I got some of his records here. Let's see. Most hits. He set a lot of records in his rookie season, but most hits in the season with 262. Most batting streaks of 20 or more games in his career. Most singles in a season. Most consecutive seasons leading the league in singles. I mean, there's, goodness, there's like 40 different records that he has here. So, you know, I know the World Series thing is going to hang over his head, or people are going to hang it over his head. Maybe he won't hang it over his head. But, you know, you look at 19 years, 2,653 games, career batting average of .311, also had 117 home runs. He's not known as a home run hitter. 3,089 hits in Major League Baseball. You know, duh. Oh, by the way, he pitched in a game too at the age of 41. Pitched an inning for the Marlins, one of those blowout losses. But, you know, still gave up only two hits and one earned run. That's better than most position players who are thrown out into the field. Like I said, there's a lot of what ifs. You know, what if the Yankees were able to win a World Series in 2012? What if that phenomenal Mariners team of 2001 was able to beat the Yankees to advance to the World Series? Didn't happen. But every other credential for Ichiro It is absolutely there. So hats off to Ichiro on a phenomenal career. And again, props to him in being able to, I'm sure it was partially his call, but also Major League Baseball as well, to have him exit kind of on his terms. I thought that was very, very good. So Wax and Gum Stains is the Twitter feed. Chime in anytime if you have any questions, comments, thoughts about the cards we talk about, the shows that we do, or any of the players or baseball in general. By the way, Happy New Year with the baseball season getting underway this week. All right, let's talk a little bit about our box, the 92 Upper Deck. Now, this was one of four boxes that I picked up at a local card show, and we left it up to a poll. I had the 92 Upper Deck. I had 92 Fleer plus a box of Series 1, 93 Stadium Club, and Series 2, 93 Stadium Club. No surprise, in my opinion, that 92 Upper Deck led the way. 41% of the vote went to 92 Upper Deck. The other, or two of the other three boxes, the Fleer and the Series 1 93 Top Stadium Club, each got 21%, or 23%, excuse me, and then only 13% for Series 2 of 93 Top Stadium Club. So I was a little surprised by that. I thought the Stadium Club would get a little more play. But no surprise that Upper Deck was the winner there. And just a little backstory into how I got these boxes. So I'm at the card show, and I see one dealer's got a box of 92 Fleer. He was selling it for $15, which is, to be honest, $2 or $3 more than I would like to spend on that. But I had been eyeing 92 Fleer on eBay for a while. The lowest price I could get with shipping included, I think, was $17 or $18. So in my mind, it's like, well, if I buy this, and I'm buying it from somebody I know, I'm saving $3, and I don't have to wait for it to come through the mail, and I could just take it home right now. So yeah, I spent a couple dollars more than I wanted to, but at the same time, I saved a couple dollars more from an online purchase. 92 Fleer, I have been a big fan of for a long time. I think it's one of the underrated junk wax sets, and I think because 91 Fleer was such a debacle, and because 1992, you're right in the heart of the junk wax era, 92 Fleer often gets overlooked. And they had some really nice art cards, had some great Roger Clemens insert cards. And I think the base set is just beautiful, kind of that emerald green color, full color photographs taking up the top half of the back of the card. Good selection of rookies from the early 1990s as well. It just falls into that boat of junk wax era glut, as Upper Deck did as well. So I know 92 Fleer may not win any popularity contests, but I like it. And I remember even in 1992 buying a lot of Fleer because I was such a big fan of the set in 1990. Then the Banana Peel set of 1991 comes out, and I pretty much ignore Fleer that year. I thought the 92 set was a great comeback effort. Good quality cards, good, you know, subsets within it. It just got overshadowed because by 1992, you had a lot more of the premium sets that were going front and center as opposed to the factory base sets. Now, 93 Stadium Club, what's interesting about those real quick is I don't recall buying a lot of Stadium Club in 93. And 1993 was the last year as a teenager that I really spent a lot of time and money on cards. But for the most part, other than buying a lot of Tops and a lot of Upper Deck in 1993, I mostly spent a lot of time kind of collecting some of the sets from the past, not only picking up some vintage cards from the 60s and 70s, but buying a lot of 87 Top cello boxes and you know, collating sets there, you know, picking up a lot of packs and boxes from the mid-80s, and also expanding my hockey card and basketball card and football card collection. So Top Stadium Club, I didn't have much of a connection with that in 1993, but I was surprised it didn't get quite as much play because in terms of cash value, if you go through the PSA grading process, some of these cards are still worth several dollars if you get a PSA 8 or higher grade. Now, of course, it's kind of a coin flip because you're pulling these out of packs, and who knows the condition of the cards or the packs. But I do think it is worthy of opening these up, and I'm going to have fun, whether I do it for the show or just my own time, ripping through these, because I think it's going to be pretty neat kind of going back into what was a very 1993 design for you know, that particular set. Now, the other three boxes, so the two Stadium Clubs and the Upper Deck box, I picked those up from another dealer, and this guy is great with the Junk Wax era boxes, just marking them down low, 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 to where you can have one of those, well, why not moments. And in fact, it's the same dealer I bought that box of 92 tops from a couple months back. So I come to the table, and he's selling these boxes for $9 a piece, or 2 for $15. So I'm looking at these, and I'm just like, And I'm trying to make up my mind. I'm like, well, there's some Upper Deck here, but these Stadium Clubs, I don't really want to rip into these Stadium Clubs, and I'm kind of waffling on it. So finally I go, well, if I were to buy all three of these, it would be $24. So I asked the guy, I said, can I get these three for $20? And he kind of hemmed and hawed and went, okay. And, you know, he's a good dealer. He's a good guy. So I'm like, you know what? You've already marked it down. I'm really trying to come in low here. Let's split the difference. Three for 22. Okay, here we go. Here's 22 bucks. So all four of these boxes, $37. Basically, I bought them each for $9.25. And why not? You know, that's basically what it is. Am I going to be, you know, putting down a nice down payment on my kids' education with any of these cards? Hell no. But if you're just looking to open up a box of cards and have some nice childhood memories, and who knows, maybe pull out an autographed Ted Williams card, which I didn't, by the way, or some other gem of a card from some of these sets here. Like I said, if you go through the grading process, you might end up with one of those cards that you could resell for several bucks and actually make your money back pretty quickly. So, you know, it was just a fun, why not kind of purchase. And that's how I ended up with these four boxes. I shared it on Wax and Gum Stains. I again thanked our listeners who, again, the cash contributions help us make these purchases. So whether we do a big splash of bargain bin diving or we get a vintage pack or two with that money, it all pays off here. Now, the 92 Upper Deck set, the base set is 700 cards. You add the high number series, which is kind of the Upper Deck traded series. Cards number 701 through 800. It's essentially an 800-card set. 92 Upper Deck brought you more of the same that you saw in 1989, 1990, and 91. Now, that's a good thing for collectors. Upper Deck was becoming not just the standard bearer of quality baseball cards in 1992, but you knew what you were going to get. Whereas, using Fleer as an example, or certainly Donruss, you weren't quite sure what you were going to get from those cards from year to year. Donruss had a good set in 1989, had the exploding ketchup bottle set in 1990, had the Christmas sweater set in 1991, had a really sharp set in 1992. But again, you know, like Fleer, you know, up, down, up, down, up, down. You had consistency with Upper Deck each and every year, and they still added stuff. They still innovated stuff. In 1992, for example, you had not only the Ted Williams subset, but you also had the Heroes of Baseball hologram stickers, and I did get a couple of those, one for the Brewers, one for the Mets in this box. So you had fun little inserts like that. You know, getting away from the team logo holograms that they put in every pack, you know, now the holograms were becoming something very special, you know, a neat little insert. And you also had Upper Deck really honing in on the rookie cards as well. And real quickly, I selected from each pack that I opened up in the video, I selected four cards, one card from each pack. And we'll discuss these players later on in the podcast. Now, by pure chance, three of them happened to be pitchers: Tim Belcher, Wilson Alvarez, and Todd Stottlemyre. But a very interesting story involves one of the rookie cards. In fact, it's the rookie card I pulled in the fourth pack. Tom Nevers, a Houston Astros prospect, a very interesting story about him a little later on in the program. So Upper Deck, you know, you had high quality, you had the tamper-resistant packaging, you had typically they were a little more edgier and riskier with rookie cards. So this was before Bowman solidified being the rookie card set. for collectors. In fact, 1992 was the year that Bowman went totally, you know, towards the, all right, we're going to focus mostly on rookie cards and guys who aren't going to play in the big leagues for a few years. And they've certainly cornered the market on that over the last 25 years now. But, you know, Upper Deck had consistency. You knew what you were going to get. But at the same time, you didn't know what you were going to get because of the random sequencing that they had in there. Now, that doesn't mean you didn't get duplicates. In fact, as I went through this box, there was some predictable sequencing. You know, if I pulled a Luis Aquino card, it was the sixth card in a set. Well, it might be the sixth card in a pack. It might be the eighth card in a pack. And, you know, the card that followed Luis Aquino was the ninth card in that second pack as well. So random, quote unquote, sequencing was a benefit of 92 Upper Deck, but didn't necessarily mean that you didn't get duplicates. But for the most part, you didn't end up with what was often the case with Tops, where if you bought a box of Tops, you may have five or six packs that were eerily similar to one another. Not exact duplicates, but you would have four or five cards in one pack. They appeared in another pack, and then you go digging around five, six packs later, there's that same group of cards again. And you ended up with three or four duplicates of several players in each box that you opened up. Not normally the case with Upper Deck. So Upper Deck has this nice, clean design in 1992. They had gotten rid of the whole baseline border. In fact, it was just a nice white border. The pictures with a little bit of a shadow box effect kind of flowed up off the background. Great photography, as was one of the hallmarks of Upper Deck cards for many years. And you flip it over to the back end, what do you get? You get consistency. You get the recent pitching or hitting record of the player. You get that vertical or horizontal photograph, I should say, full color taking up one side of the card. You've got that, you know, counterfeit proof hologram that's up in the back of the card. And, you know, you knew what you were going to get. The problem with 92 Upper Deck is that even though it considered or continued to consistently put out this quality product, when you look at 92 Upper Deck and compare it to 89 Upper Deck, there wasn't a whole lot of difference. This is where consistency is kind of a double-edged sword, because in 1992, when you look at the rest of the baseball card hobby, and I've mentioned this numerous times before, by 1992, everybody caught up to Upper Deck. Upper Deck sets the bar in 1989. Everyone's kind of waffling around. You start getting some quality premium sets released in 1991. And by 92, most of the competition decides, okay, we're going to make our base set a premium set. And then from our premium base set, we're going to have this even more premium subset. So, you know, take Donruss for an example. Yeah, Donruss put out a set in 1992. It was a much better set than what was put out in the previous 4 or 5 years. But on top of Donruss, you had the Leaf set. And then you had the Leaf Studio set. So you had these offshoots of sets that were raising the bar even more. So 1992 Upper Deck was the last year, if you will, of what I call classic Upper Deck. The bar-setting sets of 1989 through 1992, it stops there. Because if you look at 1993 Upper Deck has to raise the bar again, not necessarily in the hobby as a whole, but to kind of keep up with what everybody else was doing. All of a sudden in 1993, the white border, it's almost completely gone, as by 94 and 95, borders are non-existent. Or in non-existence, I should say, as collectors just wanted full frontal photography. That doesn't sound right, does it? Maybe some of you want full frontal photography, but you know what I mean. A picture taking up the entire card. That's what people wanted on the front and sometimes on the back, too. I think of the Fleer Ultra sets, the exact same thing. And everybody else was doing that. Fleer and Score and even Topps was getting into the game with Stadium Club and some of the other sets that they were producing at the time. So, you know, Upper Deck, the 92 set's a really nice set. Had a lot of fun opening it up. But again, It's the last of the quote-unquote classic Upper Deck because everybody else had caught up with them, and you had some sets that were, in my opinion, moving ahead of them. I mentioned Top Stadium Club. I really thought they reset the bar in 1991, pushed the envelope a little bit more in 1992. You had Fleer Ultra as well. You had the, the Leaf Studios set. You know, you had a lot of sets really trying to push the envelope and become more dynamic. And Upper Deck had to, you know, change their game a little bit. So the Upper Deck set of 1992 is very nice. It's very clean. It's fun to open up a bunch of packs. Neat to see some of the young stars and some of the Hall of Famers that are in there. But at the same time, you knew that this was the end of the old Upper Deck. And they had to change things up in the mid-90s, which they did. Starting in 1993, the cards got a little more glossier, the borders started shrinking, the insert cards became more plentiful, and of course, by 93, 94, 95, everybody's creating premium sets and shiny base sets and insert cards and you name it. Everybody, it was just coming out of the gills, and that's why a lot of people, including yours truly, stopped collecting because there was just too much all at one time. But the 92 Upper Deck set, the main card in there is the Manny Ramirez rookie card. You also have young star cards for Craig Biggio. You had Eric Karros, who was a big star back then, or a big rookie name back then, I should say. Of course, he kind of waned as the 90s went on. And you have a lot of young stars such as Frank Thomas and Ken Griffey Jr., Sammy Sosa, like I mentioned, and some stars and Hall of Famers from the 1980s that had carried over and really produced a nice set. There's also a unique short print card in the set as well, featuring Deion Sanders, a lapsed photography. I did pull this card from the box too, where basically there's four different frames of him running from one base to another, but two of the frames are him wearing an Atlanta Falcons uniform. The other two are him in the Atlanta Braves uniform. So the neon Deion Sanders effect still alive and well, and in fact, probably at its peak in 1992, now that I think of it. And he was able to steal the spotlight away from Bo Jackson because Bo was recovering from his hip injury at that time. So that was a neat little card there. A lot of, you know, good photography, good stars, decent rookies that were in there. But again, because this was in the glut of the junk wax era, you don't have much value in the set, which is unfortunate, but that's how it works sometimes. So if you're looking for a bargain bin blowout, like I did, there is nothing wrong with spending $8, $9, $10 on a box of 92 Upper Deck and just killing an hour or so of time, opening them up, seeing what you find. And then, you know, if you want to keep it, if you want to build a set, fine. Or you can donate them. You know, I know a lot of these 92 Upper Deck cards will be donated to Kidority Cards, part of a bigger donation that I'm making to them after cleaning up my own personal collection from the past few months. So they're going to pick up probably about 3,000 cards from me. But it's one of those really fun, why not, kind of sets. You know, you're not going to get much cash value out of them, but you can build a set rather inexpensively. In fact, you could probably buy two boxes for maybe $20, $25 and basically hand collate your own set and have a lot of leftover duplicate rookie stars and star cards and Hall of Famers and maybe some of these short print cards or the hologram cards as well. So that's one of those fun, hey, gonna kill an afternoon by opening these up and sorting them out kind of purchases. So if you're just looking for a cheap thrill, 92 Upper Deck is one of the many options of premium cards that still have some value, but you won't have buyer's remorse. Like if you just bought a couple boxes of 91 Donruss and you open them up, then you go, well, what the hell do I do with these? You know, at least some of these Upper Deck cards, you'll keep some of them. You'll want to hang on to some of them and maybe be moved to even put together your own set with those particular cards. All right, now, as I mentioned, we've got some interesting player cards I pulled here. I selected one card from each of these four packs that I opened up in the video break. And by pure chance, three of them are pitchers. But we've got some very interesting characters, to say the least. Now, in pack number one, the first card in the pack, I was marveling at a little bit because of the quality of the photography. It is a Tim Belcher card. And Upper Deck was able to make Tim Belcher bunting a ball look captivating. Now, making a bunt look captivating is quite the feat. Making a pitcher on a bad team laying down a bunt look captivating is even more amazing. And yeah, the Dodgers really, you know, hit rock bottom in the early 90s, despite winning a World Series in 1988. But Upper Deck was able to make Tim Belcher bunting the ball look like a pretty exciting event. So, you know, because I spent so much time looking at that particular card in the photograph, I said, well, let me set this one aside and give you the story on Tim Belcher. The Sporting News Rookie Pitcher of the Year Award winner in 1988 for the National League, and of course a World Series champion with the Dodgers in 1988, 14 years in the big leagues. An interesting story of how he ended up to the Dodgers. He was at first drafted by the Minnesota Twins in the 83 draft, but he didn't sign with the Twins. So he goes to the Yankees via the supplemental draft in 1984 and is later picked up by the Athletics in the compensation pool. Now, as he's going up through the Oakland system, he is traded to the Dodgers in September of 1987. He was the rather ubiquitous player to be named later in the deal that landed the A's Rick Honeycutt. Now, in baseball card parlance, this is rather important because this trade made Topps produce one of their worst airbrushed cards ever, the 88 Topps Rick Honeycutt card, where they just went over the top, airbrushing in his A's cap over his Dodgers cap, where it looks like he's wearing one of those big puffy trucker hats. Look it up. 88 Topps, Rick Honeycutt. It's a terrible card. So while Honeycutt is going to Oakland and being part of their revival, here comes Belcher into Los Angeles, and he is a hit right from the very beginning. He led the National League with 10 complete games and 8 shutouts. That was the most shutouts. He was the last starting pitcher in the majors to have more than 5 shutouts in a season until Cliff Lee had 6 back in 2011. So that's quite the stretch there. As I mentioned, part of that World Series championship in 1988, part of a big trade with the Cincinnati Reds in the 1991 offseason where Eric Davis goes to the Dodgers. So Belcher goes to the Reds, and later on he gets traded to the White Sox, goes head-to-head with the Blue Jays in the ALCS. Meanwhile, he doesn't succeed there, signs with the Detroit Tigers as a free agent, but the Tigers were starting to fall apart, so he had a really bad 94 season, ends up going back to Seattle in 95, but he gets dealt again to the Seattle Mariners. Now, he holds a place in history as he is the pitcher who gave up Derek Jeter's first major league hit, May 30th, 1995, in the Kingdom. So if you want to wow your friends with rather entertaining, useless trivia, there you go. Now, Belcher struggled in the playoffs for the Mariners as they had that epic series, the 5-game division series between them and the Yankees. And in fact, Belcher got into a confrontation, to put it nicely, with a cameraman after he gave up a game-winning home run to Jim Leyritz after the Game 2 series winner there for the Yankees. He would later sign with the Kansas City Royals, then with the Anaheim Angels, where his redassery came back again in 1999 in an interleague game between the Angels and the Dodgers. Belcher fielded a ground ball, which was hit by Chan Ho Park. Belcher runs to the first baseline to tag Park, so he tags him, but he holds the tag. You know, he kind of gives him a hug, you know, almost like holding Park back a little bit. Well, Park takes offense to that, and Belcher says something, Parks says something, Belcher says something back, which Parks said was something racist. So Park responds by basically giving him a forearm shiver to the mouth. Belcher then tries to engage, and then Park does this kind of half-ass karate kick attempt on Belcher. And that was one of the lasting images of Tim Belcher as a member of the Angels. He would finish up his playing career in 2000, briefly became the pitching coach for the Cleveland Indians for the 2010 and 2011 season. Now, another interesting pitcher, which we pulled from pack two of this box, Wilson Alvarez. And Wilson Alvarez, for those of us who live in Tampa, we have rather sordid memories of Wilson Alvarez, because Wilson Alvarez was the opening day pitcher for the Tampa Bay Devil Rays back in 1998. First pitcher threw the first pitch. Naturally, it was a ball outside, because Wilson Alvarez had some control issues, to put it nicely. But he signed a five-year free agency contract with the Devil Rays in 1998, but was only able to play about 2 years of it. Had all sorts of arm injuries, really didn't play much in, I think, the 2000-2001 season, only appeared in a handful of games in 2002, was one of the many big contract, big dollar busts of then general manager Chuck Lamar. And poor Chuck Lamar, whether it was a bad decision that he made or just pure bad luck, and the Devil Rays had plenty of that in their early years, Chuck Lamar couldn't get out of his own way. And even though some of the best laid plans that Chuck Lamar had out there just did not pan out for the Devil Rays. And Wilson Alvarez was certainly one of them. Now, he is not as big of a bust as a Vinny Castilla or even a Greg Vaughn, but he did not go rather well in the early years. But at the time of the signing, it was actually a pretty big deal, because Wilson Alvarez was the fourth youngest pitcher in Major League history to throw a no-hitter. In fact, it was just his second Major League start on August 11th, 1991, 7 years to the day that fellow countryman, fellow Venezuelan Luis Aparicio became the first Venezuelan to be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Here is Wilson Alvarez becoming the first Venezuelan pitcher to throw a no-hitter. Now, several have done it since then, but this was really earth-shattering news. And as I was going through the pack, I had mentioned that the Wilson Alvarez card, if you pulled it in 1992, it was actually a pretty big card. Now, it wasn't as big of a rookie card as, say, Manny Ramirez or Pedro Martinez or Ramon Martinez, even back in the day, or as big as a Frank Thomas or Ken Griffey Jr. But because of a pretty solid 1991 season, there was some value in his cards back in the early 90s. Now, he didn't start with the Chicago White Sox. In fact, he was a product of the Texas Rangers system and was part of the Sammy Sosa trade in 1990. So he's kind of wet behind the ears when he shows up in Chicago and in his second start throws a no-hitter. The White Sox were starting to kind of revive their prospects back then. They were kind of a basement dweller team for much of the mid to late 80s. But in the early 90s, they were showing a little sign of life and also moving into the new ballpark, throwing on the classic black and white uniforms that they still have these days. The White Sox were, even though they weren't a very good team, a lot of people were wearing White Sox gear because the colors and the logos mirrored a lot of the very popular black and silver, the LA Raiders at the time. Black and silver were very much in vogue for sports colors, and the White Sox certainly grabbed that opportunity and ran with it. Now, even though he had a pretty good 1991 season, up and down afterwards for the next several seasons, even though he was a part of the starting rotation, never really was able to mirror the same success. And eventually, he would get traded to the San Francisco Giants, along with other future Devil Ray, Roberto Hernandez. And one of the big reasons why Alvarez signed with the Devil Rays was because the White Sox at the time were spring training in Sarasota. So, hey, Sarasota, it's about a 45-minute drive to Tropicana Field. He had a family there. His kids were in school there, so it made sense for him. But like I said, just did not pan out due to injury, due to ineffectiveness, and the fact that the Devil Rays offensively, especially their first two seasons, which is when Alvarez pitched, the Devil Rays offensively were just horrid. You had Wade Boggs, you had Fred McGriff, and not a whole lot else back then. You know, eventually they would add Vaughn and Castilla and Jose Canseco. They did this little hit show campaign, which because of injuries and ineffectiveness didn't work. So Wilson Alvarez never got the much needed run support that he needed because he had an earned run average up around 5 each year. So, you know, you had to really knock the cover off the ball to help him out. Now, he did have a little bit of a revival after his Devil Rays stint, 2003-2004, as a reliever with the Los Angeles Dodgers. And then after retiring, he stayed around the Sarasota area as a pitching coach for the Gulf Coast League Orioles as they train in the Sarasota area. So good to see that Wilson Alvarez, even though he had a dreadful time in the latter years of his career, still his time with the White Sox, and in particular the early 90s, and that one moment in time where his second major league start, he's throwing a no-hitter. He's still revered in Venezuela. It's still almost like an annual celebratory day. August 11th, when people celebrate that first no-hitter thrown by a Venezuelan pitcher in Major League Baseball. Now, in pack number 3, I pulled the card of Todd Stottlemyre. Well, you know I had to throw in an old Blue Jay, right? Todd Stottlemyre, you know, I've always said that Dave Steeb is the most overlooked pitcher in Blue Jays history, and I agree. Certainly not to Blue Jays fans, but I think in Major League Baseball, he was overshadowed by Roger Clemens and Dwight Gooden and a lot of the fireball pitchers back then. But Todd Stottlemyre, when you look at the Blue Jays rotation during their World Series championship years in 92 and 93, he is always overlooked because you had, in 1992, you had Jimmy Key. You later had David Cohn. You had Dave Stewart. You had Jack Morris. You had Juan Guzman. You had Pat Henkin. You had all of these other names that were part of the starting rotation. Todd Stottlemyre is always or almost always overlooked. Now, he was not the best pitcher by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, you know, he averaged like 12, 13 wins a year. His earned run average was in the high fours. He tended to, you know, put a lot of pitches down the center of the plate, so they were often deposited over the outfield fence. But he was one of the, he was kind of like a junior Dave Steeb in the sense that he had some really crafty pitches. He was slightly maniacal when he was out on the field, but he was effective. He found ways to, if not win games, at least keep the team in the game to where their incredible offense could rescue the day. And in fact, I had this conversation on Twitter with somebody yesterday. The 93 Blue Jays had 4 300 hitters. And you look at that lineup, and that is an often overlooked lineup. You know, they have Paul Molitor and John Olerud and Ricky Henderson and Joe Carter and Roberto Alomar. And then after that, you certainly didn't really skip a beat when you had guys like Ed Sprague and Tony Fernandez and Pat Borders and Devon White, all guys who could still hit over 260, 270 at this time. So, you know, like I said, Stottlemyre was a guy who would at least keep the game close. And then one way or another, the Blue Jay bats would find a way to win the game in the seventh, eighth, or ninth inning. But he is best remembered in 1993, I'll never forget this, when the Blue Jays and the Phillies are battling it out in the World Series. There was this rather goofy rundown of the base paths in Game 4 where Stottlemyre gets caught up between second and third, and he kind of, you know, does this awkward slide into third base, and he scrapes his chin on the Veterans Stadium turf. And it's not a good moment in his playing career. And the mayor of Philadelphia, Ed Rendell, publicly ridicules Stottlemyre. He's just like, oh, you can't run the bases. Hell, I could hit a home run off you. So after the Blue Jays win the World Series in 6 games, they're having the big banner unveiling at Sky Dome a few days later. And Todd Stottlemyre is given a microphone, which is always a risky proposition. But He says, I got a message for you, Ed Rendell. You can kiss my ass. And it was a hilarious moment in his career. Not so hilarious, the following spring training, he and teammate Dave Stewart arrested in Dunedin for battery on a law enforcement officer and resisting arrest. Supposedly, Stewart was at a nightclub and refused to pay the $3 cover fee to get in. My goodness, $3. Come on. You're Dave Stewart, for crying out loud. So Stewart and Stottlemyre had to deal with that unfortunate incident in the spring of 1994. After his career, and, you know, he did win one more World Series as a member of the Arizona Diamondbacks, didn't pitch in that 2001 season, had some major arm surgery then. But after he retired in 2002, he became a stock market analyst and is today the Platinum Regional Vice President of ACN Incorporated, a marketing company that sells to telecommunications, energy, and banking services. He is also a motivational speaker. He's the board of directors personnel for several companies, and he has a rather unique website, and yes, he wrote a book too, so you can check that out. Finally, card number four from pack number four. This was an interesting one. I decided, you know, let me pick one of the prospect cards. And the prospect card that I pulled was Tom Nevers. And Tom Nevers, ironically, never made it to the major leagues, even though he was a first-round draft pick of the Houston Astros. And keep in mind, in the late 80s and early 90s, the Astros were going scorched earth. And they were drafting guys like Craig Biggio and Luis Gonzalez, and were trading for young players such as Curt Schilling, Daryl Kyle as well, becoming part of that organization. There was that big trade with the Red Sox for Jeff Bagwell. So a lot of the pieces of the Astros' mini success in the mid to late 90s were coming together in the late 80s and early 90s. And even though Tom Nevers was a first-round draft selection, never made it to the big leagues. He did spend a very long time, I think 13 seasons in the minor leagues. But what's interesting about Tom Nevers is he was not only a baseball star, but a hockey star in Edina, Minnesota. It's a suburb of the Minneapolis area. And Tom Nevers was drafted in the fifth round of the 1989 NHL entry draft by the Pittsburgh Penguins. Never signed with them, never played a game of hockey. But I thought this was an interesting story here because we've talked before about Kirk McCaskill, who had brief hockey experience before going into baseball. Larry Walker as well. A lot of people know that Larry Walker was a goaltender and probably could have played in the NHL, but had a very successful Major League Baseball career. And of course, the story of Tom Glavine, you know, drafted by the LA Kings in the fourth round in 1984 and drafted well ahead of ninth round selection Luke Robitaille, who is only a Hall of Famer and I believe the president of hockey operations for the Kings now. So those are some better known stories of players who were both baseball and hockey stars and in cases chose baseball over hockey for professional careers. Well, Tom Nevers is one of those. And even though he didn't make it in the major leagues, there is a happy ending to the story. First of all, he and his wife are big in real estate in Minnesota. They've raised a good family. And from everything that I've read, he is still very involved in Little League baseball or not necessarily the Little League brand, but, you know, youth baseball in Minnesota. So that's great. But, you know, this is one of those what ifs. You know, what if Tom Nevers chose to play hockey as opposed to baseball? Now, there's no guarantee that he would have made it in the NHL. But the Pittsburgh Penguins, you know, they did win a Stanley Cup in 1991 and 1992. And you have to wonder if Nevers would have found a way to be part of that team to play alongside Mario Lemieux and Jaromir Jagr and Paul Coffey and, you know, Kevin Stevens and Rick Tockett, and you had Tom Barrasso in goal for many of those years. And, you know, all the, you know, Ulf Samuelson, all the great Pittsburgh Penguins of the early to mid-90s. Would Tom Nevers have been part of that? Well, who knows? And, you know, like I said, his NHL career ended before it started. His baseball career, he was never able to make it to the major league level. But the good news is that he's still very involved in baseball in his home state of Minnesota, and by all accounts, living a good and prosperous life as a real estate broker, if you will, along with his wife in Minnesota. So I thought that was a very interesting choice there. And it again shows that not every top prospect or rated rookie or future star, as the Cards were branded, panned out. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they completely struck out in life. Sometimes there are players where you can't track them down. You don't know what happened to them. But there are others who were able to move on to another chapter in life. And Tom Nevers is certainly one of those examples. So there you go. There's our look at 92 Upper Deck, a fun, why not, box to open up. And I'll go sorting through some of the cards I picked out again, hang on to some of them, and the mass bulk of those will be donated to Kidority Cards, who we had as a guest a little earlier on several months ago. So you can check out that podcast about Kidority Cards. And if you have any cards laying around that you would like to donate that get repackaged to kids who pick out their favorite team, and Kidority Cards will send them a monthly package of cards featuring teams that the kids pick, some current cards, some older cards as well. That is certainly a great outlet to send those extra cards that you have their way. So, 92 Upper Deck. It was a fun, why not? And next episode, 2 weeks from now, we're going to put away the junk wax and we're going to open up some vintage wax. Again, really looking forward to 1977 Tops. We've got the vintage pack that we're going to open up. And we will also talk about the fine or not so fine art of airbrushing, which Topps really had to put out their best effort in 1977 with the Mariners and the Blue Jays coming on board. And with nothing but a list of players selected in the expansion draft. So we will talk about that in our next podcast. Now, if you want to keep the podcast going, not just current episodes, but the archive as well, and if you would like to help us pick up some of those cards, those packs and boxes and card lots along the way for us to talk about, your donation is always appreciated, no matter what the amount, whether it's a couple dollars or a little more, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And again, thanks again to everybody who has contributed along the way. And thanks to you for listening. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. This is Wax Ecstatic, and we'll see you 2 weeks from today.